Our first case is People in the Interest of a Minor Child, O.C., concerning the interveners, C.M. and C.M. The argument is set for an hour, half hour per side. Are both attorneys ready?
Yes, Your Honor. There are actually three attorneys
ready. All right. And you?
Good morning.
It's case number 2012 SC 835. The petitioners will have to keep track of your time. And Justice Boatwright is not participating in this case. And I want to mention to everybody that we all have, well, most of us have iPads. And so we'll use that to read our briefs, read our notes, and also have links to both the record as well as Westlaw. So we're not surfing, we're not sending emails, so that you know that. With that, we'll start. One other thing. Please tell us your name and who you represent at the time you start speaking.
Good morning, Chief Justice and Justices of the Court. My name is Melanie Jordan. I'm an assistant county attorney with Jefferson County, and I represent the petitioner in this matter, the Jefferson County Division of Children, Youth, and Families. With me at council table is Catherine Madsen. She is the guardian ad litem for the children, and she will be splitting her time with Ms. Ross, the attorney for the interveners.
Okay.
May it please the Court. Your Honor, the statute at issue in this case, 19-3507-5A, is ambiguous and capable of multiple interpretations. The statute states that parents, grandparents, relatives, or foster parents who have the child in their care for more than 3 months, who have information or knowledge concerning the care and protection of the child, may intervene as a matter of right following adjudication with or without counsel. The requirement, the 3-month custodial requirement, and the knowledge and information requirement can either apply to all of the listed interveners or apply only to foster parents. And the Court of Appeals chose the interpretation of those requirements, the custodial requirement and knowledge requirement, applying only to foster parents and not to grandparents or relatives. There are 2 reasons that this court should interpret the statute as we are urging, which is to apply the custodial requirement and the knowledge requirement to both grandparents and relatives. And the first reason is that an interpretation that does not require grandparents or relatives to have any knowledge regarding the care or protection of the child would lead to an absurd result. In addition, the interpretation that better preserves the legislative intent and better fits with the overall statutory scheme of the Colorado Children's Code is the interpretation that requires the custodial and knowledge requirement to apply to all interveners.
Counsel, could I interrupt you for just a moment? I noticed that you say grandparents and relatives, and you're specifically omitting parents, and is that tied to your reply brief argument that you think we should read the word parents out of that string of the list, parents, grandparents, and relatives?
Your Honor, thank you for raising that question, and I can address the issue of the inclusion of parents in the statute at the very beginning. The legislative history suggests that parents was added to this statute in order to ensure that parents would have the ability to intervene in cases after testimony by a county attorney that they had the discretion to add or to not add respondents. And indeed, the Court of Appeals had a great deal of concern about that discretion that the county attorney has and whether parents would be able to participate in cases. And upon further review of the cases cited in our reply brief and also of our overall statutory scheme, this has been a difficult issue for us to struggle with because in Jefferson County, we always name parents as respondents. There would never be a circumstance in which they would have to intervene because they're named as respondents. So do we do that because we have the discretion to do that, or do we do that because we're required to do that? And I think that the answer is that under the Court of Appeals jurisprudence in this area, which has happened since 1997 when the statute was adopted, they have made it very clear that parents do have a constitutional right to be involved in these cases. And specifically, the AH decision, which was cited in our reply brief from 2011, cites Santosky in stating that because the parent has a fundamental right to maintain family relationships free from governmental interference, The government must meet certain due process and equal protection standards before constitutional rights can be extinguished. And that was in the context of an APR proceeding and not a termination of parental rights. So I think that case and the cases that preceded it have made it clear that if parents are not involved in our cases, if they're not named as respondents, then we have no ability to make orders regarding their parenting time, to make orders regarding ultimate allocation of parental responsibilities, or to terminate their parental rights. And so in every circumstance, we have to name those parents in order to do that. There are also other provisions in our statute that offer protections to parents outside of the intervention statute. And in fact, although the county attorney does have discretion to add respondents who are not perpetrators of abuse or neglect, the judge under 19.3503 also has the authority to add any respondent that he or she believes is necessary to the action. And so that is an additional protection for parents to be added as respondents. In addition, the county attorney's decision does appear to be reviewable as an abuse of discretion about whether or not to add respondents. But the overall response to your question, Your Honor, is that there would not be a circumstance where parents would have to intervene because they should be named as respondents due to their constitutional rights to be involved.
Ms. Jordan, yes. Can I ask you for a favor?
Yes.
Would you mind toggling that thing down a little bit and then speaking into the microphone so we can all hear you?
Certainly, clearly. I apologize, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So there would never be a circumstance in which intervention would be necessary. However, to the extent that this court believes that parent is unconstitutional as it exists in the statute and renders the statute unconstitutional, I would argue that this court can strike the word parents from the statute and preserve the overall constitutionality of the statute and the legislative intent, which was to define who could intervene, but also to have some limits on the persons who could intervene. And the test that the court must use to do that is the test in Dahlman versus Ritter. And this statute seems particularly susceptible to a limiting construction and to striking a very small portion of the statute while preserving the overall intent of the statute.
What rule of statutory construction do you want us to apply here? Is this a plain meaning or is it ambiguous?
Your Honor, the statute does appear to be ambiguous. We did argue in the lower court that the plain language should suggest one interpretation, but clearly since the Court of Appeals has interpreted in a way different from our position, it is ambiguous. It's capable of more than one interpretation. And so we would ask that this court apply the canons of statutory construction, looking at the legislative intent and what the legislature intended, looking at the legislative history, and looking at our entire children's code in interpreting what interpretation is in the best interest of the children.
So what policy reasons do you advance for your interpretation?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What policy reasons do you advance for your interpretation that the legislature intended this 3 months provision to apply to all the named categories?
Your Honor, at the time the legislature adopted 19.3507-5A, the Court of Appeals' previous case law on these issues all involved grandparents and persons intervening who had a history of custody of the child. They did not necessarily have custody at the time that they intervened, but they had a history of intervention, a history of custody at the time that they intervened. And the Court of Appeals decision in MDCM stated that the code read as a whole anticipates that those having custodial experience with the child have sufficient interest, knowledge, and concern relative to the child to bring them within the classification of interested parties. So prior to 19.3507-5A, there was no intervention statute within our code, and the intention seems to have been to define who could intervene. And based on other provisions of the statute and based on what the courts had been allowing up until that point in terms of intervention, it seems clear that the persons having custodial knowledge of the child, whether those persons be foster parents or whether those persons be relatives, are the persons who are intended to be able to intervene in these cases.
So the adjudication process itself just goes to the parents?
Yes, and right? This is just dealing with post-adjudication interventions.
Why isn't it just as logical that the General Assembly wanted to be sure that the family was able to be in the proceedings and whether or not they had any custodial, you know?
The General Assembly has been very clear in other portions of the statute relating to the family's rights in the case. And so the General Assembly has shown that they're able to be clear about what they believe that family members' rights should be in the cases and other portions of the code. So intervention is certainly one way that families could be involved, but there are a multitude of other requirements that the county has in making sure that family and relatives are informed and stay involved in the proceedings. And to say that the assembly would have intended for any relative, regardless of their custodial knowledge or their knowledge or information period about the child, to be able to intervene would contravene what they've done in other portions of the statute. And I would refer specifically to our statute at 19.3.402. In that statute, the county is required to exercise due diligence in contacting all grandparents and other adult relatives within 30 days of a removal. Those relatives and grandparents are identified by parents, and parents are advised that they have to list those relatives or the risk that the child would not be placed with their relatives. However, the court has discretion to determine if there's good cause not to contact those relatives or delay contacting the relatives, including family or domestic violence. And I think that that portion of the statute shows a recognition that the families that we're dealing with in dependency neglect cases are not always perfect or ideal families. And then often there may be a history of family domestic violence, there may be a history of sexual abuse, there may be a history of drug abuse, and that allowing any person to intervene in the cases, regardless of their custodial knowledge, might lead to a result where there are persons intervening who do not have the best interest of the child at heart, and who do not have any information regarding the child. And so I think that's contrary to the rest of the statute.
Let me just ask you a question, though. I mean, merely intervention doesn't mean success. Can't the judge just sort that all out once the various parties have intervened?
Your Honor, if I understand your question, could the judge
eventually... You seem to suggest that someone might intervene who doesn't have somebody's best interest, the child's best interest, or even knowledge. But that kind of thing, I mean, intervention is not the same as success on the merits. And what I'd like you to talk about is why, as a policy matter, it doesn't make sense at least to allow the intervention so that all the parties are there and then so that the judge is making the decision as to the best interest of the child as opposed to the rules of procedure, if you will.
And I think with this court's recent decision in AN versus AC, looking at what the right of intervention means, we now are certain that it's a full right of participation in all of our proceedings. And so while the judge can certainly limit the evidence that's presented to relevant evidence and can put some limitations on perhaps time limits for cross-examination and do things like that to try to make the proceedings proceed in the best interest of the child, it is difficult when you have multiple persons involved and perhaps one of them or two of them or three of them, there's no limitation on the relatives that can intervene, not having any knowledge of the child or any past history with the child. And I'm concerned that it also would impact the fundamental due process rights of the parents. This court in the AN versus AC decision looked at the Eldridge factors and specifically the second prong as to whether or not full participation of the foster parents in the termination proceedings would impact the fundamental due process rights of the parents by increasing the risk of erroneous deprivation of parental rights. And I think applying that same factor to this circumstance, this court was very clear that part of the reason, or perhaps the main reason expressed in the opinion, that the foster parents would increase the accuracy of the court's decision was the foster parents' custodial knowledge and experience. And if relatives are participating in every hearing, that could include placement hearings, it could include treatment planning hearings. They would have access to all the information regarding the parents' treatment plan and their progress in those proceedings. Then the relatives would have the ability to participate essentially unfettered in those proceedings without necessarily having the knowledge that would increase the accuracy of the court's decision.
Yeah, with all of that, the parents get some pretty weighty constitutional consideration in their favor, right?
Your Honor, in terms of deprivation of termination of parental rights, Yes, absolutely. But if it's a placement hearing, the standard for the court to consider is what is in the best interest of the child. So it would not be the same weighty constitutional protection for their rights that they would necessarily have in a termination proceeding. So I think full intervention by relatives with no custodial knowledge in all proceedings, not just termination, not just APR proceedings, not just a placement hearing after a termination has occurred, has a greater impact on parents' due process rights than participation by relatives or persons with custodial knowledge would. And certainly...
That isn't exactly clear to me. I mean, due process is the opportunity to be heard, and this is a proceeding that affects the entire family here, possibly making a disposition outside of the family entirely without hearing what the interests are and keeping that family intact in some way, even though it's a broken family.
And I think there are two responses to that question. So the first is that the family still has multiple ways to participate, to be involved in the proceedings without intervening. If they have custody of the child, they have a right to be heard at the hearings, they have a right to notice of the hearings. They also have a right to request placement within 20 days of a motion for termination being filed, which is what the interveners in this case did. And so they can have a placement hearing, even not being interveners, if they file that request for placement. And that is indeed what happened in this case. So it's not necessary that they become interveners in order to participate. And the second answer to that is that although and the legislative intent cited by the Court of Appeals is one of preserving and strengthening family ties whenever possible, there are also multiple other portions of our code referring to legislative intent that I think are equally relevant, which is that we must proceed with all possible speed to a determination that will serve in the best interest of the child. And then in 19.3.100.5, that one of the primary things the courts must consider is safety for the child and removing barriers to permanency. And then judges, attorneys, and guardian advisors are urged to ensure that permanency occurs for children in foster care. So there's one reference to strengthening and preserving family ties. There are multiple references to moving towards permanency for children, particularly for young children. And while we're required to make due diligence efforts to locate that family, and parents are given every opportunity to locate that family and to allow them to intervene, we still have to look at what is in the best interest of a young child and look at permanency for that young child. And I am concerned that allowing multiple relative interveners in our cases would potentially have an impact on that permanency.
Counsel, before you move to your next point, I hear you essentially making total policy arguments, and your policy argument is fewer interveners the better. Is that sum up your policy argument that you just made?
Your Honor, the policy argument, it's not that the fewer interveners the better, it's that those persons who have knowledge of the child and who have had custody of the child should be permitted to intervene, but those persons who do not have knowledge of the child should not be permitted to intervene, and there are multiple other ways for them as relatives to be involved in the case and to request placement for the child without intervening. But to allow them full intervention is problematic due to due process reasons and due to the need for permanency for children.
And that's what I was picking up on. I mean, your argument based on the permanency desire, I heard you saying that it's just a lot of trouble to have a lot of interveners. I guess you're saying it's more complicated than that?
It is more complicated than that, Your Honor, because if interveners have full party rights, then it seems that they would be able to request placement hearings be set, to request visitation hearings be set. And in our cases, there really are two interests that we have to keep paramount. And those interests are the fundamental rights of the parents to the care and upbringing of their child and the best interests of the child. And if we are having to then have visitation for an aunt who doesn't know the child, hasn't had custody of the child, then we have taken the focus of the hearings away from reunifying the child, permanency for the child, to an extraneous issue of visitation that is not necessarily something that we need to be focused on. And so I think that is a concern. But my arguments are not only policy arguments. I think that there's a sound legal reason for interpreting the statute as I'm
okay, can you tell me that?
Yes. In addition to the canon of statutory construction that it would lead to an absurd result to not apply a custodial requirement to grandparents and relatives, I made the argument regarding due process, but I would also add to that that the subsections of 19.3507 B and C, which are in the same section as A, of course, or the same statute as A, both refer to the county's duty to give notice to relatives who have custody, and it would lead to an absurd result to say that the legislature intended for the county to have to give notice only to relatives who have custody, but to allow any relative without any custodial knowledge to intervene. It doesn't fit with the overall legislative scheme or with our code.
Do you think this statute, whichever way we decide the construction on this point, what this phrase applies to, bars anybody from intervening?
No, persons who have custody of the child for, and maybe I don't understand your question.
Well, it seems on the face of it that this statute provides an intervention of right for somebody, and we're arguing about who that is.
Yes.
But does it imply that the court is prohibited from allowing anybody to intervene?
You know, this is the statute in the Children's Code, that the only statute that deals with intervention. And the Colorado Rule of Juvenile Procedure 1 states that when there's a juvenile rule of procedure or a statute within our code that applies, that the rules of civil procedure do not apply. And so I would argue that 24A does not apply to our cases because this is the statute that defines
intervention. So your argument is this is the exclusive provision for intervention.
For intervention as a matter of right, yes, I would argue.
Well, but that's not my question. Mm-hmm. Not as a matter of right, but as a matter of discretion on the part of the judge. But did I just hear you say you thought the rules, the civil rules allowing intervention do not apply, and therefore, unless one can intervene under this statute, he can't intervene at all?
I am not aware of any prior applications of Rule 24B, the permissive intervention rule, in our cases. And we don't have a permissive intervention statute in our cases, within Title 19. But I don't think that permissive intervention would be inconsistent with the goal of Title 19. So because our statute does not speak to permissive intervention or whether or not that is something that is allowable, I do think that 24B, the permissive interstatute, could apply.
Okay.
So just to sum that up, in your view, the statute supplants 24A for this context, but not 24B?
Yes, Your Honor, because the statute defines mandatory intervention for our cases.
Thank you.
Can you address the mootness briefly?
Yes, Your Honor. We certainly would concede that the court's ruling today will not affect the legal outcome in this case because under our interpretation and the intervener's interpretation of the statute, the intervener has now had custody for 3 months, and so the intervener would be permitted to intervene under any interpretation. However, I believe that two exceptions of the mootness doctrine do apply in this case, and those would be that this issue is capable of repetition but evading review, and also that it's an issue of great importance. Frequently in our cases, somebody who might not qualify as an intervener initially may qualify as an intervener down the road after they've had custody for 3 months. And so I think that that could come up again repeatedly in our cases, making it difficult for this issue to be reviewable by any appellate court. And it is an issue of great importance in our cases. We need to know who can intervene in our cases and what the rights of those interveners are. And so it is very, this court's determination in AM versus AC is very helpful in our administration of justice, and we do need a decision on this issue as well in order to be able to effectively manage our cases.
Could you just explain, it was a little unclear to me, what's happened during the pendency of this case that we find ourselves in this situation? You said the grandparents now have custody and have had?
Yes.
And how did that happen?
I'm not the trial attorney on this case, so I will try my best. But Ms. Madsen certainly has good knowledge of all the facts in this case and can also answer questions on this issue. My understanding of what happened is that the grandparents did have a contested, the intervener grandparents did have a contested placement hearing. following the termination hearing, and that they were granted placement at that contested placement hearing. And so they have now had the child in their custody for 3 months, or for more than 3 months now, so they do qualify as interveners.
So they were not granted a right to intervene, they were just granted placement.
Yes, and a right to a contested placement hearing, which is what 19.3605 contemplates. So that again goes to my point that there are multiple ways for relatives to be involved without being full interveners in our cases. Hmm.
Can you actually give me your plain meaning interpretation of the language? You said you abandoned it due to the court of appeals, but I'm wondering if you can give us a short rendition.
My plain meaning interpretation would be that there is no separate category for parents, grandparents, relatives, or foster parents. There's no indication within the reading of the statute that the custodial requirement and the 3 month requirement would only apply to foster parents and not to parents, grandparents, or relatives. So that would be my argument. I would also note that the Court of Appeals noted in its decision that the courts have not adopted the last antecedent rule in interpreting statutes. And I think, again, that the plain language of the statute is that those requirements apply to all persons within the statute. There was no indication in the legislative history that would suggest that the legislature intended that they only apply to foster parents.
Thank you. Although I think the caveat, I think, to your interpretation is that except for parents, for constitutional reasons.
Yes, and again, this when the statute was adopted in 1997, the law and the constitutional jurisprudence on this issue was not as well developed as it is now. The Court of Appeals has made at least 3 decisions that I'm aware of since 1997 when this statute was adopted that make it very clear about parents' rights to be involved in these cases and that the court does not have jurisdiction if the parent prevails in an adjudicatory trial. And prior to those decisions, I don't know if it was common practice, but it certainly was practice that if that one of the parents prevailed in an adjudicatory trial, the court would still enter orders because they had an adjudication as to the other parent. So I think that jurisprudence makes it clear that parents do have a right to be involved in these proceedings and that they're being named with more frequency now in petitions. They're being named all the time in our petitions, whereas they were in 1997.
I was going to say, quite apart from the constitutionality, though, and what requirements there were, just simply the fact that parents were included in this litany say anything about whether the legislature intended to limit the right of parents to intervene to only those who had had care for 3 months?
I'm not certain what the legislature's intent was in adding parents beyond their concern that the county attorney had discretion to add or not add respondents, and the court was concerned that parents needed to have as many ways as possible to participate, or not the court, but the legislature was concerned and wanted to make sure that parents had as many ways as possible to participate in the proceedings.
But does your interpretation then suggest, though, that the legislature would have intended that parents not be permitted to intervene unless they had had care of the child for 3 months? And you've sort of used this kind of fringe doctrine of absurdity going the other direction, but does that suggest an absurd result, that they would have intended to bar a parent from participating?
My understanding is that the word parents was added before the limiting language of the custodial requirement and the knowledge and information requirement. So I'm not sure whether or not that the legislature intended or considered whether or not those requirements would apply to parents or not. The legislature was concerned in committee hearings about the broad language that was initially added to the statute and did add language intending to limit the persons who could intervene. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
You may. Wait a second here. Hold on a second. Argument is set for half hour aside.
Your Honor, I'm appointed as guardian ad litem. I'll be arguing for the first 15 minutes, and the intervener, Ms. Ross, will be arguing for the second 15 minutes.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Good morning, Chief Justice. Justices of the Supreme Court. My name is Catherine Madsen. I am the guardian ad litem representing the best interests of OC in this matter. As this court is aware, the purpose of the Children's Code is to serve the best interest of the child. As such, each provision of this code is to be construed as serving the best interest of the child. The ruling by the Court of Appeals that we are addressing here today does not serve the best interest of the child as it has been construed. The Court of Appeals ruling, as the court is aware, holds that parents, grandparents, and relatives may intervene without having a child in their care for 3 months. On its face, this interpretation seems to be in the best interest of the child. After all, why would we not want to have as many relatives come in to protect, seek care, and look out for the best interests of the child? The reality is, however, in these cases, that not all family members seek to come into cases with the best interests of the child at heart. It should be up to the trial court to determine who should intervene in a matter. It should be up to the trial court to determine if those who have had custodial interests are in the best.
Well, now, how does a judge decide on the front end of the intervention motion whether or not the best interest of the child is at play in the intervention?
I apologize, Your Honor, was I unable to hear you?
Yeah, I don't understand exactly how a trial judge can decide in the first instance whether or not the particular relative is, in your view, representing the best interest of the child. Isn't it perfectly logical that the legislature would want to hear from the family?
It is logical that the legislature would want to hear from the family. I would argue that Colorado Rules of Procedure 24, the permissive intervention statute, would permit those relatives who had not had a child in their custodial care to intervene. In that motion, that relative could delineate their interest in the child, their history of care of the child, and then it would be up to the trial court to discern if this person is appropriate to intervene, if this person has the best interest of the child at heart. It would be up to the trial court to determine perhaps this person, it's not an appropriate time for them to intervene. Perhaps this person does not have the best interest of the child at heart, and it's not in the best interest for them to become a party to the case. As a policy argument, my concern is that the interpretation by the Court of Appeals of this matter divests the trial court of discretion in determining who is appropriate in these cases to intervene. And my concern is that if this statute is applied across the board, relatives who are not appropriate to intervene in a case will become parties to the case. Such relatives may be persons who have a history of abuse and neglect of the child previously, or persons who have history of abuse and neglect of the child's parent, or who have a history of substance or alcohol abuse. These are very real considerations and factors that appear in our cases.
So there may be some you're going to exclude all.
Excuse me?
Because there may be some of those in the pack.
Correct.
You're going to exclude all, right?
It's not going to exclude all. Again, the permissive intervention statute would permit other relatives to come in who do not meet the 3-month requirement. My concern is that allowing these inappropriate relatives to come in, they may not come in to be served in the best interest of the child. My concern is that the three-month custodial requirement ensures that the persons coming into these cases do have an interest in the child, do have knowledge of the child. Those who have not met that 3-month requirement do not necessarily have knowledge of the child. We can't assume that because there's family members that they have knowledge of the child or have the best interest of the child in mind when they seek to become a party to the case.
Could I interrupt again right here to pick up on Justice Ide's earlier question and I think Justice Cook's question about what exactly happened and how things unfolded in this case and what these grandparents did. to go ahead and participate absent an intervention of the right. How did it work out for this set of grandparents?
The facts in this particular case became quite complicated. The OC was in a foster adopt home for an extended period of time. I believe she was there for about 16 months at the time of the contested hearing. During her placement there, there unfortunately was a report of institutional abuse that required the child to be removed from the home. The report was unfounded, but in the interim, the child was placed with extended family members, specifically aunts and uncles, after that removal. During that time, that's after it was post-termination, that we had the court set a contested placement hearing, and at that hearing, and the placement hearing was between the foster parent and the grandparents, and at that hearing, the court determined that the child be placed in the custody of the grandparents. That is how the child is there today.
And the grandparents were participating in that hearing through what statutory provision?
The parents were participating in that hearing as witnesses.
Through the grandparents or the parents?
Excuse me?
Who was participating in that hearing as witnesses? The grandparent?
The grandparent, CM, was participating as a witness in that hearing.
But then at some point they became parties.
Correct. After the child had been placed with them for 3 months, they became parties. I believe it was on April 13th after a motion to intervene was again filed because a 3-month custodial requirement had been met.
And I'm just curious, so this whole case kind of just proceeded normally, even though we accepted cert?
It did.
You understand that normally cases, when you appeal a case, the trial court is divested of jurisdiction?
Yes, I am aware of that. However, we were considering the placement hearing of the child. We had an emergency circumstance where we had to seek permanency or start to achieve permanency for this child. And I don't believe the decisions by the child trial court were contrary to the status of the case having been before the Supreme Court.
You said, though, I thought that after the grandparents were granted custody of the child temporarily, that then they were permitted to intervene in this process. Is that right? Was a motion? I mean, was it the question of their right to intervene on appeal? How were they permitted to intervene?
Your Honor, I wish I had a better answer for you than that the court did sign an order on April 13th permitting.
And maybe I can ask you, just because of the timing, did the court somehow feel that the opinion of the Court of Appeals, which had not become final because it was pending in this court, was controlling in some way or gave the judge leeway to go ahead and grant intervention or in effect reverse his earlier order?
Well, I believe that the court was following the statute was following the 3-month custodial requirement of the statute. I don't believe the court was, because it was uncertain, the court was not following the Court of Appeals ruling at that time. It was waiting for the 3-month requirement. So that is my presumption, as the order was entered after the 3-month requirement.
In other words, it was looking at a fresh motion to intervene and analyzing that brand new motion to intervene under the statute.
Or did the time just pass?
I do believe the time just passed. I apologize, Your Honor. There have been so many motions on this case. It's hard to sometimes keep the time frames of each motion fresh in my mind.
Can I just ask one more question, though? I think you suggest that permissive intervention is kind of the answer to this.
I do.
But did the grandparents really were granted permissive intervention?
I do believe in one of their motions they did request both intervention as a matter of right and permissive intervention under Rule 24, and the trial court denied both of those motions at that time.
So help me understand that. How can you say that permissive intervention is the answer if permissive intervention was not granted in this instance? I guess I don't understand that.
In this case, the grandparents lived out of state. They live in Illinois. They had very little contact with OC. They did not intervene until, or seek to intervene until 5 months after the case was opened, when I believe she was about 7 months old. They had little knowledge of the child. And there was extensive family conflict at that time between OC's mother and the grandparents. Given those certain facts, it did not seem, I presume the trial court did not seem that it was appropriate for them to intervene. I believe the trial court believed it was their discretion to say that this is not in the best interest of the child, for this family, to intervene right now. That doesn't mean it would happen in all cases. In other cases where you have a grandparent who provides daycare for the child while the parent is working, a grandparent who has extensive knowledge of that child, who's been there in the child's life since day one, but technically has not been considered to have custody of the child, that type of grandparent would be appropriate to intervene in the case. That type of grandparent could provide information that would be useful to the court.
Thank you.
The ruling by the Court of Appeals also lists several unintended consequences. As I believe was discussed by the petitioner, the concerns about creating potential delays in achieving permanency for the child. The Children's Code has very strict timelines regarding various proceedings and achieving permanency for a child, whether it be adoption, permanent placement, or another long-term permanency plan. By allowing multiple interveners to participate in cases, it is not that it will be inconvenient to the court or inconvenient to the parties. It's that it will create unnecessary delays as we proceed through perhaps, say, multiple visitation hearings to determine where the child should be placed. Disagreements about other issues that may come into play. The reality is that there could be, for example, there could be three interveners that want placement of a child. In that, we would have to have several different hearings to determine the placement of the child. And given the time frames we have, we run the risk of exceeding those time frames, of delaying the permanency for the child. And that.
But I guess, I mean, wouldn't that just be a good thing if there were three families that you got to choose among to see who could do the best job for the child? I mean, my experience, I have to tell you, from doing these somewhat like cases in Denver District Court, was that usually we had nobody who wanted the child, or two bad choices. And that the more people who would come in and offer to help or to have some best interest of the child, the better. We were begging for that kind of thing. And so it's hard for me to understand just anecdotally from my experience why you think this would take so much more time. Why the floodgates argument? I don't understand it based on my own experience.
And my concern would be that we would have relatives who are not appropriate, or relatives who do not know.
But why would they come in and want the child? I mean, maybe for bad reasons, but that could certainly be fleshed out pretty quickly.
Right. And this statute would, by permitting relatives to come in as a matter of right, would permit those relatives to come in regardless of their intention. I would, by the permissive intervention statute, I go back to that, would allow, we want relatives to come in. That statute would allow those relatives to come in without meeting the 3-month requirement. So if we have multiple relatives that want to come in, there is that avenue for them to do it. Allowing any relative to come in as a matter of right runs the risk of inappropriate relatives. I go back to that, of coming in and perhaps, to be frank, muddying up the dependency neglect case, which is supposed to be focused on the best interest, of the child. And the other thing I would like to remind the court is that intervention is not the only means to seek placement. The code anticipates that relatives will be sought for placement under 923-508 and 923-605. So to be considered for placement, I think it's very important to remember that you do not need to be an intervener. And certainly, our first priority when placing a child is to look to relatives, and the statute does provide for that. And, Your Honor, I do see my time is up.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Hillary Ross, and I represent CM and CM in this matter. The interpretation of Section 19.3507.5a that is being urged by the petitioner and the guardian ad litem in this matter is erroneous for three reasons. First of all, it's inconsistent with prior case law and the statute's legislative history. It would also result in a potential deprivation of fundamental parental rights for non-custodial parents, who would be left with no mechanism to intervene if, for whatever reason, they were omitted from the petition, dependency, and neglect.
Well, don't they have permissive intervention to address that?
It's possible that they would be allowed permissive intervention. However, if this is a parent who has fundamental constitutional rights with respect to their child, they should be allowed to intervene as a matter of rights in order to exercise those fundamental rights. If it's only permissive intervention that they're entitled to, then there's an exercise of discretion there. And the exercise of constitutional rights cannot be left up to an exercise of discretion.
And just to follow up, can I get you to respond to your opposing counsel's argument that there's kind of a constitutional overlay on that word parent, that we treat that sort of differently, I guess, because of constitutional concerns, and then the rest of the list should be subject to the three-month requirement?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe Your Honor is referring to the petitioner's argument that the statute was enacted prior to the... Yes, I can address that. Petitioner suggests that this court should strike parents because it's no longer necessary. After the United States Supreme Court enacted or issued its decision in Troxell versus Granville. However, as the court in Troxell noted at page 64, the fundamental rights of fit parents to the care of their children are 75 years old. And the court even says, quote, that they're perhaps the oldest of the fundamental liberty interests that were recognized by this court. These fundamental rights were firmly established when the General Assembly was considering Section 19.3507.5a. Nothing in Troxell changed that. Yet, it's clear that the General Assembly still intended to add parents to the statute. There must be a reason for that. And that reason is because a fit parent must have the opportunity to intervene in order to be able to exercise their fundamental rights in proceedings with respect to their own children.
I guess I don't understand your point. What's the point you're making? We're talking about grandparents and the statute. So how do you want us to interpret the statute?
We believe that the statute should be interpreted as parents, grandparents, relatives, on one hand, and foster parents who have had the child in their care for more than 3 months may be entitled to intervene as a matter of right.
The neat thing about that is that you've mentioned the whole family.
Correct, Your Honor. And applying this three-month requirement only to foster parents makes sense. Courts have consistently drawn a distinction between foster parents on one hand and family on the other. For example, in People in the Interest of MDCM, the Court of Appeals drew a distinction between potential intervening parties that have knowledge of or a relationship with a child, such as a foster parent, and biological relatives who are, quote, entitled as a matter of right to intervene. Family, whether or not they've ever had a child in their care for any length of time, is likely to have information that could materially aid a court in making decisions, including placement decisions. Information such as family history, family medical history, and even the all-important family dynamics that are generally going to be present in these cases. Foster parents, on the other hand, have a contractual relationship with children that's created by the state and are virtual strangers to the children unless and until they've had the child in their care for a significant amount of time. This interpretation is also consistent with the legislative history of the statute. As the petitioner pointed out in their reply brief, In the hearing before the House Judiciary Committee regarding 19-3507, the legislature expressed concerns that parents who were omitted from a petition may not have any mechanism in order to be able to participate in these types of proceedings. Given this goal, applying a 3-month custodial requirement to a parent isn't logical, because that would not protect the fundamental parental rights of all parents. It would only protect the fundamental parental rights of custodial parents.
Counsel, with respect to your statutory interpretation, can you address how you think our recent decision in, I think it's AM, impacts that interpretation?
I believe that AM is consistent with our interpretation. In AM, the court analyzed whether or not foster parents who would have the child in their care for more than 3 months were able to fully participate in proceedings. Nothing about allowing foster parents to fully participate is inconsistent with applying the 3-month requirement only to foster parents.
And recognizing certain factual context of that case, but I was thinking about the actual wording of the discussion doesn't seem to distinguish between foster parents and everyone else. It just says, you know, the subsection of dispute, which provides for intervention by certain individuals who meet these two requirements, a custodial requirement and a knowledge requirement. And do you think that impacts, at least how this court has viewed that statute thus far?
No, Your Honor, I would still read that as being consistent, because it is true that certain individuals do have to meet a 3-month requirement, those individuals being foster parents. The issue of whether or not the 3-month requirement applies to all categories of potential interveners was not something that was before the court, but I believe any explanation that the court had with respect to whether or not the 3-month requirement would apply to all parties would be dicta. But even so, I still believe that is entirely consistent with interpreting it as applying to only foster parents. Within the Children's Code, the statutes express a consistent preference for relatives. For example, in section 19-1102, the statute says that it's a goal of the Children's Code to preserve and strengthen family ties wherever possible. The Children's Code also consistently grants a preference to relatives in placement decisions. And section 19-1117 provides for a specific mechanism for grandparents to seek visitation with their children. But I think perhaps the most important reason why the 3-month requirement should be interpreted to apply only to foster parents is that there are severe unintended consequences if it is applied to all potential interveners. As petitioner noted, that there is no circumstance where intervention would be necessary. However, I believe that's incorrect. County attorneys, despite all their best efforts, may not always have complete information about who a potential parent might be. And as the petitioner noted, they have the discretion to add or not to add a parent as a party to a dependency and neglect action. If a fit parent has no way to intervene as a matter of right to exercise their fundamental parental rights with respect to the care of their children, then that the exercise of those rights would, in essence, be vested in the sole discretion of the county attorneys. Constitutional rights cannot be discretionary. As this court reaffirmed in AN, due process in dependency and neglect matters requires that a parent be given notice and a hearing and an opportunity to call and cross-examine witnesses. There's no way that a parent could be entitled to those due process rights unless they were a party to the case and therefore were able to intervene. The petitioner also contends that this court should strike the term parents from the statute in order to read it as constitutional. However, this statute can be read as constitutionally as written by only applying the 3-month requirement to foster parents. The petitioner also hasn't stated any valid policy reasons which would require the drastic step of striking language from the statute.
Have you handled these cases a lot?
Your Honor, I'm sorry?
In your career, have you handled many of these cases?
I have not, Your Honor.
Okay. I'm just wondering then what your comment would be about the troublesome relative.
I'm sorry?
The troublesome relative.
Your Honor, I'm happy to speak to that. Certainly dependency and neglect cases come about for a reason, and that's usually because at least someone is alleged to be a troublesome relative. Generally, that's someone who already has care of the child. Someone is alleged to have a drug problem. Someone is alleged to be abusive or neglecting the child. But that's someone who already has care of the child. While I certainly understand that it's difficult for trial courts, even the way things stand, to make sure that only pertinent information is getting across to them and that these troublesome relatives don't create too many collateral issues. As this court emphasized in AM, in rejecting an argument that allowing foster parents to fully participate in termination hearings would bog down proceedings, trial courts have an inherent ability to control their own courts and to control the flow of evidence and to ensure that additional cumulative evidence isn't presented to the court. In fact, this court called trial courts the gatekeepers. And the same analogy applies here. While there may be additional interveners, although I don't think that that's a huge concern, considering being an intervener is a commitment of time and money and energy and a willingness to share confidential information with people in your family or people who are foster parents. So I don't think people will just be intervening willy-nilly unless they truly have an interest in the child. But the goal of a trial court is ultimately to make the right decision based upon all information that is reasonably available to it, and not just the most expeditious decision. There are also concerns noted about potential confidentiality issues or, as you said, inappropriate relatives intervening. However, denial of intervention based upon an arbitrary custodial requirement isn't going to weed out the potentially inappropriate or abusive relatives. Again, it's up to the trial court to determine whether or not someone's participation is helping or hindering the process and making adjustments accordingly.
Ms. Ross, could I ask you to address the question of mootness and the related question of jurisdiction below?
Yes, Your Honor. So just to clarify the timeline, after the Court of Appeals issued its decision, the trial court issued an order making CM and CM interveners. That happened before the mandate was issued, and I believe it was just an error. After the petition for writ was filed with this court, that order was revoked, withdrawn. And
the intervention?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And in, I believe, the beginning of December of this year, or last year, there was a contested placement hearing, as the petitioner spoke about. And as part of that hearing, CM and CM were given custody of the child. I believe, I apologize that I don't have that date in front of me, but the three-month requirement was met. It had the child in custody, in their custody for 3 months. As of, I believe, the middle of March. A motion to intervene was then filed at that time, because under any interpretation of the statute, whether the three-month requirement applies to them or doesn't, they had met the three-month requirement, and therefore were entitled to become interveners as a matter of right.
So it was a renewed motion?
Yes, okay. It was an entirely new motion based upon the fact that they had had the child in their care for 3 months, and therefore, irrespective of what this court were to decide with respect to whether they were allowed to intervene at an earlier point, there's no question that they were allowed to intervene at that time.
And so the effect of that, though, would be to rule on intervention, which is pending in a higher court, and as your motion indicates, because of what the lower court did, moot, or arguably moot, the question that's pending in the appellate court.
Yes, Your Honor. Certainly at this time, my clients have intervener status, and therefore there is no live case or controversy as with respect to their rights. I'll briefly address the petitioner's contentions regarding whether this is capable of repetition or evading review. Unfortunately, I don't think that this situation falls under that particular exception to the mootness doctrine, simply because had the outcome of the contested placement hearing gone differently, then certainly we would be standing here today and my client's rights would be very much in play. I guess I think back to the law school example of capable of repetition yet evading review, which is pregnancy, which is obviously going to end very shortly and before there can ever be any ruling with respect to it. And I just don't think that the facts indicate that here. Whether or not it's an issue of importance, obviously a lot of that is up to this court to decide. It is an important issue, but it is an issue that the Court of Appeals has already ruled on, and so were this court to not make a decision based upon mootness, the Court of Appeals decision.
Okay, I didn't practice this area, but it seems like the trial court, at least this one, had a life goes on situation. It's up in the Court of Appeals, but I got to keep going with this. Is that the usual custom, that the petition for certain one of these cases doesn't interrupt the ability to go ahead and make temporary placements and move on towards the permanent? I'm just curious about that.
Well, Your Honor, as I mentioned, this is not the type of work that I normally do. However, in my experience, in my understanding of the Children's Code, what is of paramount importance is making sure that these kids are placed and quickly. And this child had been out of the home for years, and she was past due needing permanency at this time.
Okay.
I see my time has expired. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I thank all the parties for what we have rebuttal. Apologies. You know, this is the first time since I've been on the court that we've had 45 minutes on one side, so make it quick.
I'll be brief then, Your Honor. I think it's important to distinguish between placement and intervention. Placement, relatives can get through a variety of means through our statute. Intervention would mean that a relative without custodial knowledge of the child could intervene even when a parent has the child in their home, even over the parent's objection, and have full participation in a hearing, in the hearings and in the proceedings. So the line should really not be drawn between the parent, between the relatives and foster parents. It should be drawn between parents and relatives. Relatives do not have a constitutional right to the upbringing of children. Their rights are statutory, and to confer rights upon them that the legislature did not intend and that don't keep with the overall intention of Title 19 would be.
Ms. Jordan, do I understand what your argument is, that at the time of placement with the grandparents, they weren't a party to the case? Is that your point?
That is my point, Your Honor.
But aren't you actually saying the difference should be parents versus everybody else?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor, that is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And it would be contrary to allow interveners, relative interveners, to participate over the objection of parents and relatives who have no custody when parents have custody. Often in our cases, parents retain custody and are just subject to the orders of our court. And so I think that's an important distinction as well, and presents some issues with Troxel that the court needs to consider. I would like to give an example in closing, because I know the court has been struggling with how would this be problematic. It is becoming a disturbing reality in our practice that often when parents lose in domestic cases, they coach their children to make allegations such that they end up in dependency and neglect cases. And after we do a full and thorough investigation of those circumstances and determine that those allegations were unfounded, then we would be looking at providing treatment to ensure that those type of allegations don't happen again. Often, families through the domestic process have become so conflicted that you have a family on one side who believes in their whole heart that this other parent has committed whatever allegation of abuse has occurred. And that family could then intervene even when the parents have retained custody and could have full participation in contested visitation hearings and contested placement hearings and contested APR hearings. Rather than just participating as witnesses in those hearings, they would be parties in those hearings and have access to parents' treatment plans and confidential information. And that is the type of case I'm concerned about. So for that reason, and the reasons I stated earlier, I would urge this court to adopt our interpretation and to overturn the Court of Appeals decision. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank all the parties for your arguments. The case is submitted on the brief.